I'm Amy.
I'm Wendell.
And I'm Patrick.
And
this is
Yes
But Why
Podcast.
Thank you, Bobby Del Rio, for being on the podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to chat with me.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, Bobby, how did you first get involved in the arts, in theater or music? How old were you? When was your first experience?
When was my first experience? The way you say it.
I don't mean it to be dirty. Scandal. No. I mean, you know, like, did you do musicals in high school? Were you in a band? How did it start for you?
So I guess I was always like an actor, even as a child. So even my earliest memories, even at the age of six, I think I was like Wally the Woodchuck or something in a play. It's just always what I did. Like I did take it very seriously, but I didn't take it professionally. Not until I was a teenager, like a late teenager, like maybe 19. But it was just something I always did. I was always the lead in class plays. I would always be the person to speak at assemblies, anything. I don't know. I guess I was, enunciate as a child.
Do you think that you, did you put on performances for your parents and stuff like that?
I never did things like that. My brother and my cousins did that. I think I was kind of like a secret performer or something.
Secret.
Like I was really good at it, but like, I wasn't really that kind of kid, you know, like I wasn't really like, I don't know. They say there's really like two kinds of performers, right? There's sort of like the sort of perpetual extroverts and the perpetual introverts. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I would definitely fall into the latter. I mean, I was really just a straight A student, a little bit quiet. You know, I had a good sense of humor, but for the most part, I was a pretty quiet kid. But then, I don't know, something about you put me in front of a bunch of people and give me some lines to say, and I just would never leave, you know?
Hmm. So was it the acting that got you into it? You said 19 was when you really started taking it seriously. So was it an acting gig or a directing gig, or what got you into it?
It was definitely acting. I had no interest in anything beyond acting until I enrolled in like a theater program. Mm-hmm. And then I remember it was like me and this other guy, and it was basically a two-hander. And my friend had written this play, and we won this like sort of merit award at the University of Toronto Drama Festival, which, you know, at the time in our world was a big deal. And I remember being quite impressed because he was like, we were the same age. I think we were 19, 20, something like that. And he won this merit award and he'd written the play. And I was like, whoa, like, I didn't even know people could write plays. But then I was like, I don't know. It just was not in my world of experience at all. And it was pretty good. And then I was like, if he could do it, maybe I could try it. And then I did. And then, I wrote a play, and then I produced it that summer. It did okay. It didn't really do that great, but a journalist for a newspaper called I Weekly really liked my concept. And so my first play was basically about the abuse that a creator can have over his creations. And I paralleled that to the potential abuse in a family.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was really light and funny right out of the gate.
You're just a comedian from the very beginning. I totally understand. I went to college for theater as well, and I was obsessed with, like, torture plays. Like, any play where, like, one character tortured another, I was like, give me those plays. Yet now, in my career, I do comedy. That's all I do. Not to say that there isn't a mild amount of torture in that as well.
Well, I will say this, though. Comedy, and I started doing comedy as well. Like, I think we have similar backgrounds. Like, I really did a lot of comedy, sketch comedy, improv before I did, like, dramatic performance. Mm. did that for years. But I do find that, you know, the sort of relationship between comedy and pain is a pretty close one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, well, you can't, I feel like the basis of making an audience laugh is making everybody feel like they're on the same page. And oftentimes the only thing you can do to connect with other people is to connect on a negative thing. That's why, so, I'm sorry, I'm going to go on a weird tangent, but go with me. When I teach, so I teach sketch comedy and improv to new students, and I'm always talking to them about how, like, it's okay to go down this rabbit hole of emotion if you think that the audience is with you. Like, they're like, but it's not funny. And I go, but it will be. You know, like once everybody gets together, makes the connection together as a group, then whatever happens will, you know, grab them all. And then laughter is just sort of a natural response to, you know, either surprise or, you know, amusement, something that they didn't expect in that way. But yeah, seriousness can be very helpful to comedy.
Well, I just think that it, and again, I mean, I'd have to, I don't know, read many books about it or something, but I think there's something about, like, the love that you get from an audience. You know, like, I've done so many different styles of performance. I mean, now I have a 20-year career now, right? Mm-hmm. Working professionally. So this does not include Wally the Woodchuck when I was six. So I performed in many different ways. And what makes comedy very interesting is that it's really the only form of performance that's results-oriented. Like, if you don't get a laugh, you've kind of screwed up in comedy, you know? Like, there is, you know, you can sort of people can applaud politely or be amused or something, but at the end of the day, you really are looking to evoke laughter. And so, and I think there's a relationship between that sort of immediate gratification that of sort of like love that a comedian sort of thrives on and needs to function. To the point where I find, like, the people who I find the funniest are really the most haunted people emotionally.
The most haunted emotionally. I suppose that makes them sure. Excellent performers in any right, whether it's serious or, you know, funny. But, yeah, they can – I feel like most of us feel like we have a certain level of being haunted. And when we find somebody else who either does it like we do or does it better, we like to connect with them in that way. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm sure there's many examples of people who are well adjusted and hilarious. I just don't know many of them. I mean, Jim Carrey had a really, you know, I mean, his struggles with depression his whole life. And look at Robin Williams. John Cleese apparently underwent a lot of therapy and sort of, I had a therapist tell me that John Cleese stopped being funny once he worked all his issues out. And this was my therapist. And I was like, okay. So, and he knew I was in the industry. So I was like, okay, so are you saying that I should, I don't know, be fucked up or remain fucked up in order to do my job? Like, I didn't really understand where he was going with that.
No, there's
but it was
a bit
of a warning.
Yeah, but I feel like that's a something that people like to say, and unfortunately in the world that we live in where people there's a lot of people who are taking like depression and anxiety medication. I have a lot of friends who are creative and are afraid that these drugs are taking that creativity away from them. And I don't think that's the case. You know, and I don't know that being happy would take away your ability to be funny. I mean, even just what you mentioned to me earlier. So you say when you were a kid, you were just a performer. It wasn't something you were trying to do. It was just who you were, right? So that's naturally who you are. Whether or not you're happy or sad, you're still that guy, right? And I feel like when you're a kid, you are the purest essence of yourself, of course, right? You don't have all the other things hanging on you, like real life and feeling bad. But
well,
you know,
I don't know.
That
like
way.
To be honest, like I didn't really have the happiest childhood.
Sure.
So I think that you know, I'm just a very honest person, right? So I think that like there's a relationship between, again, and I say this not just with comedy, but everything else, but especially if with comedy. And I don't know, I'm just thinking out loud. But this was definitely, I think, why I really started in comedy for years before I did other forms of performance. But for me, definitely that sort of like environment of levity, of love, of happiness, I think that was something that I didn't really have in my life. So to get that on a stage, I think was pretty cool. And I don't know, I mean, it's hard to, I'm not, you know, a psychologist or anything, but understanding the psychology of the performer for obvious reasons is somewhat of an obsession of mine. Like, I take an acting class right now, ongoing. I'm 40, right? But I take ongoing Meisner classes with Robin K. Pilarski here in Toronto. She's brilliant. And it's just amazing the relationship between, you know, sort of the personal psychology of the performer and their ability to perform in front of an audience. You know, and you really do see, like, people who have experienced, it's not a competition, but like sort of copious amounts of sort of trauma and pain, they just become more compelling performers. I just haven't seen that refuted effectively. I've never seen someone who's never really felt pain in their life just be able to be a brilliant performer. Like, I think there's a reason that you've got those two masks of you know, comedy and tragedy, you know? They're part of the same thing that I think you need to do this job and to do it well.
Yeah, but don't you think that every person deals with ups and downs in their life? People have a certain level of trauma, no matter what it is. Even people who, you know, have a lot of money or seem to have everything that you would imagine a person would need, there's ways to be very sad about those kinds of things and to have ups and downs. So I figure, like, any person technically has enough sadness, if that's what you need, they have enough to grab onto if they want to be a performer. I think it's a matter of, I think people who are creative are just more attuned to the emotion. Like, some people just ignore the emotions that they feel, and some people really deeply feel them. And the deep feelers are the ones that end up being performers. And sometimes those performers do a lot of great things, but sometimes they crash and burn. I'm sure you and I are the same age, by the way, and we're not dead. We have such a great career ahead of us. And all the people that we've known along the way, I'm sure some people that you know and I know have crashed and burned. Like, they tried, they did it for a little while,
yeah.
But, you know, it's too much for them. But they're feelers.
I'm not saying pain is the only prerequisite to, you know, sort of a lasting creative career. But I do think that there are varying degrees of emotionality. And, I mean, yeah, for sure. I've seen people who've experienced lots of trauma. And, I mean, I guess we're going deep now. I mean, I had a girl from my graduating class kill herself. Mm. And she was in my my acting class, you know. So,
yeah.
You know, I'm very aware that, you know, just because you feel a lot of things doesn't mean now you're a great actor. But I do think there's a relationship. I think I also agree with your point that there is a sensibility. But I think that you kind of need both. I don't know, just like, I know a lot of really brilliant performers, and I just disproportionately you see some of them have endured, like, really, really traumatic things in their lives. And then it's not a surprise that they can access these sort of deeper levels of pain in their work that I think can really transcend a genre in a way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But then some of them become alcoholic, so I don't know.
Yeah, right? Sometimes it goes well, sometimes it doesn't. I was like, I got about 6 stories of people that I'm like sad that they're, you know, living where they're living, doing what they're doing, but, you know, they're fucked up, so what are you going to do? But let me shift gears here slightly, because we're going down a bit of a sad rabbit hole, and bring us to, you just mentioned genre, and it made me think of your series, the IRL series. And I was reading about it in your on the website about how it started out as an exercise in improvisation to create the stories, and then shifted into sort of a more official, like, writer's room building of a television show scenario. So for
you...
you
do your research.
I tried to do a little, yeah.
Wow.
So as far as that, also it's, like, super cool, the idea of improv. And, in fact, I've just been... It's funny, when I read it, I was like, this is so perfect. I'm so glad I'm talking to you. Because right now, we've a bunch of friends and I have been having the discussion about improv and how to use it. Whether, you know, having the age-old discussion of improv, is it just a performance thing that we should keep pure? Or can we use it to build other things? And some people I know are building other things, and some people are not. So how was your experience building this show using improv, and how did it progress for you?
Okay, so I've been doing improv my whole life. So even when I was in high school, like, we had this whole class called comedy class, which was basically, you know, kind of creating Second City style sketches based on improv. And it was a whole class.
In high school?
Yeah, yeah, it was really cool.
Oh, God bless Canada. All right, keep telling me about it. I'm so excited. That's wonderful.
Well, look, that's uncommon. It's not like every class is doing that. I had a great teacher, Michelle Jardine,
awesome. And
it was her concept. And we basically, that's what we did. We learned improv exercises, and then we did a bunch of, you know, sort of like character-based improvs. And everything just culminated in a sketch show that we would perform essentially for the school at the end of the term. And I did it really, really well. My friend and I, in fact, we were basically the stars of the class. So then we did it again the next year for no credit. We did, like, the entire thing again. So
yeah.
We just loved it. So improv, and again, like, I was really a comedian and, you know, a sort of improviser. Like, in the way I would define myself. Like, I mean, I was always an actor as a child or whatever. But when I was about 16, I started taking all these classes, and I started doing well and winning awards and stuff at school. So then once I went to theater school and I started doing more dramatic work, like, improv was such an area of comfort for me. And then if you know, I think back now, the next 20 years of my career, I mean, I have worked utilizing improv as part of my creative process so many times that it's really an invaluable tool, both dramatically and comedically, in projects that I initiated and projects that other people initiated, because I was so comfortable doing improv. And for whatever reason, a lot of actors are not comfortable doing improv.
Yeah.
It's even amazing how many comedians are not comfortable doing improv. I mean, for sure, tons are. I mean, there's a whole community, but I was quite surprised, because I guess for me, because that was my background, I sort of equated improv with traumatic education, but it really isn't that. I mean, it's a really particular sort of skill, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, that background helped me in many ways, right? Because it also helped when I became a writer. Like, in a way, when I write my scripts, I'm the fastest writer that I know. Like, I can write a feature screenplay in 24 hours.
Oh.
And, like, I've published plays I've written in 24 hours, and I've, you know, optioned screenplays, and I have this sort of storied tradition of doing this all around the world. But really, the reason I think that I can do it so quickly is I'm essentially just improvising by myself.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm really just like, oh, and then this could happen, and yes, and then this could happen, yes, and I don't block myself, and then it's really as fast as you can type. I mean, if you think about it, people, they improvise sitcoms and plays all the time, and it takes 90 minutes to write a 90-minute show because you're doing it in real time. So why am I taking 24 hours when it should be doing it in 90 minutes, you know? But I think that's why, right? Because essentially it's just it's improvising. So I'm very comfortable working that way. So when it came to this IRL show, you know, it started as a Facebook post where I was really just bored, and I was like, hey, who wants to work with me? And a lot of people, you know, sort of knew my reputation. I was pretty successful in Toronto, more behind the scenes. Like, I was a guy who really got stuff done. I was a programmer at a pretty respected film festival. So people knew that if they worked with me, I had a pretty good ability to get attention for my projects.
Right.
So then 65 people signed up in 36 hours, which is too many people. So I really thought like 5 to 10 people would sign up and I would make a short film. And then once 65 people signed up, I was like, okay, I don't know what the hell to do. So I had this meeting and I was like, okay, I'm not sure what we're going to do, but I guarantee you it'll be good. And then like half the people left and half the people stayed. And then I was like, okay, let's just start improvising on the theme of social media and see what happens. And that's how it began. And then we did that for about 6 to 9 months. And then we did an Indiegogo, and then we get so much attention. We were pretty well organized from a marketing spend perspective. And then Bell Media was like the biggest media corporation in Canada. They found out about our idea through our Indiegogo, and then they messaged me on Facebook and bought our show before we'd even made it.
That's wild.
Yeah. And that's when I started shifting from the sort of improv-centric mode to a sort of more established television process.
Had you done that before you had worked on this series? Have you worked on, television series before?
I'd worked in web series. I'd been in a writing room for CBC Television. I don't know if CBC is like one of the biggest channels here in Canada, broadcasters, whatever. And
Yeah,
I didn't have that much experience, but like I was hired before as a writer with very senior people to do pilots. So, I'd been writing feature screenplays around the world, and I worked collaboratively on a feature film called A Winter Tale, where I was hired as essentially an actor and a writer. Hmm. So it was like they took like, there's like 10 of us or something. And then we all it was like several weeks where we would build workshops based on improv and then build characters, help build the plot. So I'd worked collaboratively many times and had a lot of success doing it. So, you know, with my sort of limited writing room experience and lots of collaborative writing experience, I figured, well, how hard could it be? So, partly, that's really was the thought process. I was like, I mean, if I screw it up, the original plan was I was just going to write the scripts myself. So I was like, well, if I waste people's time in this room, then I'll just go back to plan A. But I'm glad I didn't, because I hired some really, really great writers. Writers who've got some real credits now. I mean, after that, I mean, one of our writers got hired by Orphan Black and now Shadowhunters. Other writers are winning awards. We put together. I believe in 10 years, people are going to look back in our writing room and be like, "Wow, like that's one of the strongest writing rooms any web series in Canada has ever had."
That's so great! What a great experience that you were able to put together. I love it. It sounds to me like all of the experience that you had going really was just so perfectly well suited to creating this project. Did you, as far as projects like this, have you ever, I see that you've worked on other projects, but like, was this the one that you were, you know, the most in charge of as far as like this whole, you're the creator of the whole thing? Other projects, I'll see you build as director or actor, but is this one that like you, this was your baby from beginning to end?
To be honest, I'm usually in that position. This was just the, so that's why I was never daunted with the responsibility of it, because I've been doing this since even in university. Like I remember we had sort of like an annual sketch comedy show, and one year I was the director. So I was basically the same thing. I was the head writer, so I had a team of 10 writers, and I worked with them to get what I thought were the best sketches in the show, and then I cast everybody and I directed all the actors and I was in it and stuff. So I'd kind of always done this, but not at this scale. I mean, this was 75 people. This was working directly with the biggest broadcaster in Canada. this was, you know, a cast of, we ended up having 35 people in the cast. So it's definitely like I had all the skills, but I don't know. I'd never had to use them all in this way like I did, but it was also a pretty logical, I don't know, extrapolation. I mean, I had also written, directed, and produced a feature film, not too far before there, like maybe within 6 months to a year before I made IRL. Mm-hmm. So this was definitely the most ambitious, but by no means did I ever feel like I was out of, you know, my element or anything.
When you, the movie you're talking about, is that the Market?
Yeah, the Market. So yeah. We just rebranded as a web series, actually. So we're going to be launching internationally this year.
Awesome.
Finally, yeah. Finally.
Working a lot to get that international, huh?
Yes.
Great.
Yes. Great. Yes. I mean, it's yes and no. It's an interesting world, right? I was offered distribution by two sources. One was as a feature film, which was originally what it was, and then I was offered distribution to rebrand it as a web series. So I decided what I would do is rebrand it as a web series because it's a lot more accessible and easier to access the international market through YouTube than it is through a feature film going through the traditional channels.
How do you have these kinds of connections? Like, I know that you mentioned that you had, you know, jobs previous. You've been writing screenplays around the world, and I'd love to know what around the world means, but we'll get to that. You worked in a writer's room for a CBC show. Is that how you're connected? Also, you mentioned that people know you as a person who can get promotion done for their work. So, like, what? How did you make these connections? Is this from college? Is this, like, from your job with CBC? Or, like, are you the best networker in Canada? Or all of the above?
I might be. Okay, so first I'll relate an anecdote, and then I'll answer your question. So I remember I was at a networking conference for artists or something like this when I was like about 24, and then this guy stands in the middle of the room, and he's like, and he's a good friend of mine to this day, he's like, "My name is Billy, and I'm the best networker in this room." And I walk up to him 30 seconds later, I go, "Hi, I'm Bobby, I'm number two." So networking was always something I was very comfortable with, but to answer your question, I do have lots and lots and lots of connections for many reasons, a 20-year career. But I think ultimately, although I am a very strategic person, that's not why I get things done. And I don't think it's why I have the connections I have. I think that I'm the kind of person that does what I want to do and nobody stops me and I will always find a way. And I think that when you have that kind of personality, you could drop me in any room, and by the end of that night, when I have a project, I'll enlist 15 people in that room to work on my project. It has nothing to do with the fact that, oh, whatever, like 10 years ago I worked with this person here, or 8 years ago I worked with that person. Those things all help, and for sure, like some random coincidences come into my life where it's people I hadn't worked before, or I had, or I did, or whatever, blah, blah, blah. At the end of the day, I think it doesn't really matter because I think it's ultimately about personality. It's just my theory.
Yeah.
And so I just get things done all the time. There's not really a way to stop me because I have like fierce ambition coupled with a lack of fear. So I just, like, I'm just going to do what I want to do and no one's going to stop me.
That's,
you know,
so
like
great.
even when I was 25 years old, I remember I was picking fights with the biggest classical theater companies in Canada because essentially they were racist, right? So they were like 98% of all their casts were Caucasian people, which is fine, except, you know, Toronto's 50% non-Caucasian. And that was the sort of the broad casting pool for these companies. So I started to get very angry, and I ended up getting major national press for these issues, even though I had people warning me that I was going to be blacklisted, and to some extent I was, but I also didn't care, right? And I was very, very effective. And if you look at the makeup of those companies today, they've changed dramatically. And partly, and a big part, is the pressure that I put on them politically at the age of 25. And I was never worried for even a second, because I don't care, because I do the things that I want to do and nobody stops me.
That's so great. Yeah, did you grow up in Toronto, or is that where you have landed after college?
Yeah, for all intents and purposes, I've always been in Toronto. Like, I was born here, and then my parents moved to the Bahamas for a few years to pursue teaching. And then I lived in London, Ontario for 3 years. My dad went to law school there, and then we moved back here when I was in grade four, and then I've been here ever since. Now, I do work around the world, but my home base is in Toronto for sure.
Yeah, it seems like an excellent home base to have if you want to be in television and film, for sure.
Yeah, and look, increasingly, especially with the emergence of web series, YouTube, you know, the web as a sort of distribution platform, I think you can be anywhere. But Toronto, it's a good combination because there's a lot of mainstream American film and television that's made here. Mm. You've got a pretty thriving theater community. You've got actually a really, I'm not sure if the word is dominant, but I'll say dominant, sort of web series production community. And I always say that because disproportionately you see a lot of pretty good web series come out of Toronto. And I think it's because there's a lot of us here who, if you don't sort of pursue or get the government funding for Canadian film and television, you're making web stuff, right? You're making indie films, and there's a lot. There's so many people who know what they're doing here, partly because of all the mainstream film and television that's here. So you just have a sort of rich tradition of independent filmmaking in Toronto. And increasingly, that's moving to the web, partly because also the edgiest ideas won't get funding from the Canadian government, because the Canadian government is looking to do stuff that's essentially an advertisement for the Canadian government.
Sure.
So, and a lot of, you know, creative people, you're not interested in making a corporate video for your country. Like, you want to tell a real story.
Right.
So you just, I don't know, you just have this sort of thriving web series community in Toronto.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a good place for me right now.
Absolutely. I've always wanted to go to Toronto. I was very excited when I saw that that's where you were from, because I was like, yes, cool, let's hear about it. And I'm excited that it provides a creative hotbed for you to not only, have ideas and make them work, but also to have the, you know, people around you that can help you make it. That's so awesome. I know a lot of people all over, the U.S. who have, you know, tiny little communities that don't have much. I'm in Austin, Texas, and thankfully there's a lot here. There's a lot of improv schools. There's a lot of, you know, like straight theater. There's musicals, all sorts of stuff. So I love hearing that there's other places where it's thriving and things are going well. But as far as traveling goes for you, tell me about writing screenplays all around the world. Are people watching you do your screenplay in 24 hours magic trick across the world? Or are you doing festivals? How does that – tell me what that means all across the world.
Yeah, okay. I think that people are just – like I say, I think that like somebody could go through all the steps that I've gone through and not arrive at the destination I'm at, because I think it's just my personality, to be honest. You know, like I've done, 30 to 50 podcasts in the last few months in the United States, and almost everyone asks me back. I think that I'm able to connect with people just by who I am. And I'm pretty, like, aggressive and committed, and I'm pretty skilled at what I do. So this is all a preamble to say people just, they read my stuff and then they like me and they want to hire me. And that's pretty much just been my whole life, right? So, like, there's actually a lot of people from Toronto that migrate to LA.
Yeah.
And so what happens is, so I have two screenplays right now that have been optioned by a producer in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So one was made an offer for $900,000, which my team turned down. Don't get me started. There's
that
just
wasn't
other
enough.
Issues at play. No, apparently wasn't, because
no.
there's issues in terms of this star and if that person's attached and this person has to play that role. And
sure.
This is like one of the biggest movie studios in the world with U.S. theatrical distribution guaranteed.
That's right.
But whatever, like, it's fine. Like,
solid,
I'm just one of two writers
there.
On that. The reality is, you know, that everyone's got their own business agenda. What I've learned in my sort of like limited exposure to Hollywood at this point, is that it's about money and it's about the deal. So I've learned that, pretty effectively. So for me, it's whatever I need to do to get the deal done, I will do that thing. There's no ego for me on that side of things. I it's helped me a lot, right? So like sometimes concepts will fundamentally change. Or this person, now they want this star, and then you gotta write all this extra stuff for this star. But if you do it, then that investor will put in that extra $2 million. And at the beginning of my career, I was like, I will never do those things. And now it's like, I will so effectively and efficiently do those things that, I don't know, like, why wouldn't you work with me? Like, I'm not going to give you any problems. I can write whatever you want faster than probably anyone. And I understand your perspective. Business. So I think that's partly why the Americans really like me, is that I understand my place. And this doesn't mean I don't give my opinion. I'm a writer. I'm going to give my opinion, but I'm not going to get in the way of the project.
No, you're absolutely very mature. Not. Saying knowing your place is like a super mature thing for sure. I know lots of people who like, you know, are in the young version of like, oh, I'm not going to sell out. And you're 100% right. If you would like to work, you will do the work that somebody asks you to do. And if you can, you know, it's not like if they're not ruining something or making it horrible, then it's like, sure, I'll make that edit. Sounds good to me.
Look, I have
a hunchback. Let's do it.
I have 100 scripts that are written, and I can write a new script in 24 hours. So if I want, I can write 300 screenplays in a year or something like that. So why would I freak out over one?
Right?
Like if there's a script that I really need to be done the way it needs to be done, then I'll direct it. I'll raise the money myself. And I do things like that from time to time. But there's other times where I'm like, okay, let me, I'm providing a service, right? Like there's a client, they're going to pay me to do, you know, certain work, and I will do that work. And what I find is that you can actually learn a lot intellectually from those interactions too, because sometimes those ideas are really good. And even though your sort of access point to the story may be different from like, oh, but this is important to me because when I was a child, I loved unicorns and it's called Unicorn, whatever. Sometimes like really, really good scripts come out of, oh, you know, it would make $1 million.
A shark tornado.
Yeah, well, sometimes terrible scripts also come out of that. But also, look, sometimes terrible ideas come out of that thing you loved when you were a child.
Oh, yeah.
For me, it's about execution. I mean, muse and inspiration are just details. I execute. Mm-hmm. That's my job.
How many screenplays have you written total? Do you know?
I've written 100.
Awesome.
Yeah, maybe not exactly. Maybe it's 80, but I have 100 scripts.
Once you do that first, like, you know, power writing, get it all out first draft, what's your process for editing? Are you mentioned a team. Do you have people that, like, help you with the editing, or do you do all the creative stuff and they just help you with the business stuff?
I don't really need help doing anything, but sometimes it's sort of part of the deal, right? Like, so for example, some producers function as editors, and that's just kind of, and you just know that you're signing up for that, right? Like, I've optioned another series up here in Canada as well, and we're starting to apply for development financing. And I know my producers also has an interest in sort of, you know, creative participation. So there's like an interplay. Other people, they just want to sell it. So I don't know. Like, I'm a pretty, with a 20-year career, I think the only reason I've been able to stay in this industry so long is that I'm very, very adaptable. And I understand relationships and I understand business very, very effectively. So, you know, if I choose to work with somebody, then, you know, I make it just kind of clear, like, what are your expectations? What are my expectations? If I know that there's a bad fit right from the outset, I mean, I'll bail very benevolently on the first meeting. Mm. But generally I don't. Generally, I find that you can always find common ground, unless somebody's a psychopath. Not that, you know, in the Harvey Weinstein world, there aren't some psychopaths, but.
Right. Sorry about that.
For the most part, I find that when you do whatever the hell people want and you do it very, very fast with no drama and no bullshit, they enjoy working with you.
Yeah. Sounds like you're the kind of guy that gets a lot of stuff done. And I see how many producers and the other members of your team would want to help you. They want to be near you. The energy of you, even over the phone, is, you know, like, oh, this is happening. Oh, this is so exciting. What's happening?
Yeah.
That's wonderful. That's so great. It means that every meeting you have, every opportunity you have to create something, you know, people are intoxicated by your energy. So what's the next thing for you? What are you like? And maybe you have like 47 irons in the fire, but like, what's the thing that's exciting you right now? Like, what are you working on? What's the, you know, books you're reading, stuff you're into? What's the next thing you think might creatively inspire you?
So I do have 47 irons in the fire, as always, but partly because I just like irons.
Sure.
You know, my biggest problem, to be honest, is that I'm trying to answer this without coming off as like a big douche.
No.
You've been lovely so far.
If my audience is 45 minutes into this interview and isn't in love with you, then they're dead inside. So no matter what you say, that you're not going to get them. People
I'm
are going to love it.
I'm single and I work out. Call me Lee.
And they're dead inside. It's so fun. So keep telling your story. You're not going to sound like a douche.
So my problem is that like I'm pretty good at executing. Like I say, I'm very fast and I'm happy to take notes and, you know, I mean, it's like, I get it. I know where I stand. I know where I fit in things. So there's never a problem with me in terms of my ability to do a job, like ever, because I'm just good at stuff, right? So it's like, I need to do this, 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 and this by this deadline. Okay. And then I'll deliver early, right? So like a trick that I'll you know, if any listener wants to hire me, then like, this trick may not work on you, but what I'll do some, I know how fast I am. So what I'll tell people is that, look, like if you get screwed on a Friday and you need someone to write you a new script by Monday, like I'm the guy, right?
Nice.
So I've done it. And something will fall apart and they need a new script. And I go, okay, I'll write you a new script by Monday. And they're like, oh my God, you just saved my life. And then what I'll do is I'll deliver Sunday. And then it blows their mind even more. Because first they can't even imagine somebody could do it in 2 or 3 days. And then they do it in 1 day or something, a day and a half. And then they were like, you know, like in their own mind, I've already set myself up to fail. And then I've exceeded those expectations. Even though for me, it's a bit of a trick because I know that I could probably do it in 8 hours, right? So, look, I know I have this sort of level of efficiency, which helps. And once I learned that our industry is essentially a bunch of business people trying to do business with artists, I was like, oh, well, I'll just help them do business. And then it's easy, right? So for me, knowing that I can do that in a way spoils the game for me because it's a little bit too easy in terms of executing. It's really hard to get, like, you know, people to give you money and to get, you know, we all know how hard it is to get a project made.
Yeah.
But in terms of everything I have control over, I mean, I'm operating at like a pretty effective efficiency rate here. So if you can get the money, I'll get it done. I know that the likelihood of a project falling apart is high, but not, it won't be on my end. It'll be on the financing end. It's always on the financing end. I would say 98% of all things I've worked on that didn't happen, it's because something happened on the financing end. It's about money. So that's okay. So I'm very, very clear about what I need to do and the sort of what world that I have to work within and thrive within in order to be effective at what I do. And I do that pretty well. So for me, what that also does, I guess the corollary of that is that I actually lose passion because like executing for me is simple. So when everything be simple, like I said, I've written 100 scripts. I could easily write 300 scripts a year. Like, that's not just something to say. Like, I could easily do. The reason I don't do it is I wouldn't remember them all. It's a lot of time spent typing. And I mean, the amount of work that goes into getting one script produced can be years sometimes. So it doesn't necessarily help you to have, I have 5,000 scripts available for you. First of all, no one will believe that you have 5,000 scripts. And second of all, what are they going to do? Like, oh, let me see your titles. And then you give them like what, like an 18-page document with a table of contents. It just seems stupid. They'd rather just like, do you have a horror movie? And you're like, here's a horror movie, you know?
Yeah.
And so sometimes what I'll do is like, if they'll ask me, oh, do you have an idea for this thing? I'll be like, yeah, of course I do. And then I don't. And then I'll just write it that night and send it to them the next day.
Do you think that you're like total immersion in the efficiency of making the business work? You mentioned that you know, sometimes that means your passion is less. Does that mean that, you know, you're less excited about the projects, or is it like, this is your job and now your hobby is something else?
I think both of those points are true. I think I love going to the gym, you know, because, oh, okay, here's something I haven't mastered, basically, right? It's like, it's hard to go and like eat all the right chicken breasts or whatever the hell, and takes a long time. And, you know, you can't just like go to the gym and, oh, now I'm fit, where in a way I can do that for a screenplay. And I give myself many challenges, right? So I write every genre. I combine genres. I create new challenges for myself. Like, I kind of like, oh, I'll do this one with my eyes closed, my hand tied, and my back. Again, it doesn't have to be a dick, but it's just like, it's something I've been doing for so long at such a high level. I mean, look, I was, you know, I had 1 year of writing experience, and they were calling me the rising star of Toronto theater in publications in Toronto, like respected arts publications. And then 2 years, and I had a documentary done about me on Bravo here in Canada, like a half hour thing that aired across Canada. So I've just had this kind of weird, you know, at 24, I think I won an international playwriting competition in New York City from Canada. And then people are pissed about that. And I was like, okay, well. So I've always like been able to like execute from the earliest age. So I guess I definitely do lose passion for it. And I definitely do look to hobbies for passion. Like, for example, like I became one of the most respected fantasy basketball writers in the world out of boredom within 6 months. And then I ended up getting invited to the most famous fantasy basketball league in the world with the most famous fantasy basketball writers. And then I finished in second place as a rookie.
Wow.
For kicks. I just did it for kicks. And like literally the people who I grew up, I mean, it's a very niche thing, but like they're all American. They're all working for Yahoo and major, you know, organizations. But I just wrote all these columns because I was like, well, you know, I was kind of bored of like, all right, well, are they going to produce this or not? Like, I've got all these scripts and I was still doing that, but I was like, well, I can just write a few articles a week for this thing. And then, yeah, like, awesome. Because I do things like pretty well when it comes to like sort of intellectual tasks. Yeah, like at some point you get bored, right?
Yeah.
So that's definitely an issue, is that I have so many scripts and I think a lot of them are pretty equally good and competent. Maybe even beyond that, maybe like in the top 1% of scripts in the world. Like, I write at a pretty high level, but I would say that my passion for those is also similar, right? It's like there's, I don't know if I love one more than another. And so sometimes maybe I think that my career, not that it suffers. I mean, I just had the best year of my career last year, but I think that there's something to be said for having, you know, like your Rocky, you know, like that film that you'll sell your dog over. I don't have a dog, but you know, I guess you could buy one and sell it for, but there's something with that script, you know, like people have that, like, oh, I need to make this. And, you know, earlier in my career, I had things like that, but I don't have things like that anymore. And I kind of miss it.
That's interesting because I was thinking that myself just the other day. I've done a lot of, you know, written a lot of sketch comedy and done a lot of performances. And I kind of hit a wall and I was like, I've said most of the things I wanted to say. Like, what is it that I need to share with the world right now? Like, and it can be a tough thing. I think it's just a matter of, like, you know, sometimes in your life, and maybe this brings us back to what we started talking about with the, like, you know, with strife comes creativity. Like, when things are not going great, you know, you can be inspired. And now that things are going well, you know, perhaps that little bit has been removed from the equation, and now it, like, can take away from, I'm not saying, like, go fall in love and immediately it shouldn't work out, because you'll be great for your career. But, you know, I mean, like, it's interesting that it, without us meaning to, we sort of came back around to this idea of creativity kind of requires a bit of, like, something to fight against.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And look, here's the thing. We're the same age, so which makes it a really good conversation because we have this similar amounts of life experience.
Yeah.
Because of that. So, you know, when you're 20 and, oh, my God, like something I wrote people like. And it's like, oh, I'm not a fuck up or something, you know, or whatever it is.
Yeah. Right?
Or it's like, oh, like, look, I can perform and people laugh. Okay, cool. But once you've been doing that for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, like, you're not really shocked when they laugh.
Right.
You're not really shocked when you did something and you worked hard on it and, like, people liked it. Like, and I think that's kind of where I'm at. And I think that happens to a lot of people who start to really, I don't know, be good at things. Right?
Yeah.
Because the novelty of and the fear, right? The fear of, like, can I ever actually do this thing? Oh my God, I've never done this thing before. It's like, okay, well, those are, like, in some cases, those are decades behind me, like those feelings. So, you know, I try not to be so insensitive. I try to see other people's perspectives, but there's, you know, when people are starting out in their careers and they've got all these fears, and to some extent, these excitements, these passions, like, they're like, oh my God, if I could only get this one thing. And then where for me, like, I've just done it so many times that I'm like, okay, well, I kind of know how this goes already. So for me, it's kind of like, well, how do you motivate yourself to get to that feeling? Or is there, like, a new level that I haven't reached yet where you kind of like, okay, this is a plateau. And what's the next? Like, for example, I had a production company from Los Angeles contact me, like, about a week or two ago because they heard about IRL, and then I guess they found out about me, and then they were like, oh, you'd be perfect to host a television series.
Oh.
So they just called me up at random, and then we were talking, and then we're still, you know, we're in negotiations to see if that's going to happen. And I was like, okay, well, maybe it's like that. Like, maybe I need to, like, do that. Or it's like me, Brad Pitt, and Matt Damon need to become friends. So now I, like, you know what I mean? Like, so there's, like, another level of this thing that I haven't quite clicked into yet.
I feel like if you're going to be best friends with any particular Hollywood celebrity, go for George Clooney.
Yeah, Clooney. Can't lose with Clooney.
Mm-hmm. He's well connected in lots of ways.
I think Judd Apatow.
Yeah, but, you know, he's good, but, like, with George Clooney, you can be in films and also save the world occasionally,
like,
if you'd like. know.
See, my problem is that I, like, I'm pretty good at getting along with people, but I won't get along with someone I dislike. Like, I just won't. I just won't do it. I have no problem telling Steven Spielberg to go fuck himself.
Yeah.
No, to be honest, he seems like a lovely man, so hopefully it wouldn't come to that, you know? But I wouldn't be afraid to do that, right? So I don't have false friendships. But I think it makes people trust me more because the people who are in my life, they know that I want them in my life because I'm not this, like, super, like, affable, hey, everybody, disco Thursday at my house. Do people say things like that?
Thursday. I'm into it. Sounds great.
Wear your sequin shirt and do LSD. I mean, I really don't know.
Whoa. The disco era was crazy over there.
Yeah, right? So.
Oh, man.
Disco Thursday.
So you talked about, just a second ago, you're talking about the new 20-year-olds, people who are just starting out. And this is my bread and butter. I teach improv and sketch comedy to 20-year-olds. I pretty much, they're my peeps. Right. And I often teach level one in both of them. Because I love
good
the news.
Good for you.
I love them when they're new. I love the freshness. I love the fear. And I wonder, you know, I think about that. Perhaps I'm like a vampire. I'm leeching off of their excitement to keep myself going, right? Because, you know, not for nothing. I still do a lot, and you still do a lot. But you talking about this plateau idea is totally like, yeah, I know what you're talking about. I kind of feel that. Now, here's a crazy theory, and audience, you guys have heard this 1,000 times. I talk about this all the time. But I think that it might help. Who knows? I have this theory that we become new, different people every 18 years, right? So the idea would be that, like, so 0 to 18, you're a kid. You're your parents' sort of, like, charge. They take care or don't, and you become what happens in your childhood. But at 18, you are sent off to do something new. They're like, okay, you're an adult now. Good luck. See ya. And you have to make decisions. You either get a job or you go to school, but you're kind of now on your own. So 18 to 36, you are figuring out who you are, what you know how to do, what you're interested in. Maybe you get a career or you just get a job, whatever it is. You go through the ups and downs of adulthood. You figure stuff out. And then when you get to 36, there's a certain level of accomplishment. Oftentimes, people are at various different paths in life. At 36, there's a sort of like, yeah, I did it. So people who had kids when they're young, right? If you have any friends who had kids when they were 20, 21, their kids are older now. They're ready to get rid of those kids out of their
house.
They're
ready to date me.
Or there's people who are, you know, got careers. They've been doing it, like you said, for 20 years now. They've been working on something since they were 18. They're, you know, developing something. By the time they're 36, they have done it enough that they're well-respected in their field. But what next? What do you do after this? How do you figure it out? And I think that and I feel like 36 – it feels young, but maybe when I was a kid, it didn't feel young. It's kind of when people have, like, their midlife crises. You know, it's when they, like, you know, cheat on their wives or buy a sports car or quit their job at the firm, whatever it is.
Right.
They
right.
want to do something else. And I wonder, those of us like you and me, we're in a career that's kind of like, nah, I'm going to stick it out. I'm going to keep doing creative stuff because there's so many possible ways to do it that it's not totally boring. I might hit a plateau, but there'll always be more for me to do. And I really just feel like maybe, so we're the same age, right? So you're right at the beginning of your third cycle. So in the beginning, we're just figuring out who we are. I'm not mad at 20-year-olds when they don't want to do with their life. They don't know if they're going to get married or have kids or have a job. Okay, figure it out. It's fine. I'm not mad at 2-year-olds who don't know what college they're going to go to, right? So I try to think of it in a way that it's like, I accomplished a lot up until 36. At 36, I was doing exactly what 18-year-old me wanted me to do. What I wrote in my college essay was exactly what I was doing at 36, right? And so great, I accomplished it. but what's next? And right now I'm feeling a little weird, and you're mentioning that you're feeling a little weird, and I'm thinking it's just natural. We're waiting till the next exciting inspiration happens, and all of a sudden we're propelled again to become the amazing person who, when we are 54, will be like, oh man, 36-year-old me would be psyched to be me right now. Right? That's what I think.
I think that's a pretty good theory. I see no holes to poke. You know? Which is somewhat dissatisfying for me because I love poking holes.
I know, me too. Oh, well, I love being the devil's advocate with things. You're so funny.
There's something to be said for, like, you know, okay, like, I did it. I figured stuff out. I put the time in. I did it. Okay, now what? Like, I'm not dead yet.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you're not going to be dead for a long time. You have a lot more to go.
Yeah, so, like, last year, like I say, was the best year of my career, which surprised me because I turned 40 last year.
Yeah.
And I just had some, like, a lot of success and a lot of publicity and I did the things I wanted to do for the right reasons and for lots of reasons. It was a really, really great year. And now this year I'm like, last year was my really great year, best year of my life. This is the year after that. So it's like anything I do pales in comparison. And like I've already had some good things and, you know, like I have some major, major opportunities, but I'm just like, okay, but like I've had opportunities my whole life and I continue to have them. And
yeah, cool, I mean, everybody will. But it's like, how do you use them? What are you going to do with them? How are they going to fulfill you on the deep side, not just fill your pockets or keep your career moving? Like, you have to be fulfilled.
Right. And this is where I'm at. So to be honest, like, I'm not fulfilled. I'm kind of like, okay, like I guess I'm successful.
Yeah.
You tell me I'm successful, so I guess I'm successful, but I guess I don't feel successful because I'm not like running down the street, like pulling rainbows out of my asshole and like luxuriating in the beauty of the earth, you know?
Oh, you don't want to do that. Both of those things sound like the opposite of stuff you want to do.
Disco Thursdays at my place.
Rainbows out the ass, yo.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I swear? I've already sworn like 11 times on this podcast.
Yo, me too. Absolutely. No, okay. I think I dropped the first F-bomb just to let you know it was okay because I didn't mention
it. Okay, cool.
Yeah, absolutely. No problem. So,
you know, part of the reason that I love doing all these podcasts, mm-hmm. and I've done a lot of them, is that I get to meet lots of really interesting people, and it's almost the only way that I socialize with new people these days.
Oh my God, why do you think I started a podcast? Hi, Bobby, now we're friends, okay?
It's pretty cool. It's kind of like people all around the world. And, you know, it's funny, like I had a really sort of like, I wouldn't say negative, but maybe like a rigid perspective of Americans before I started doing this sort of U.S. podcast circuit.
Really? Tell me about it. I'm excited. I want to know.
Well, I'm in Canada, right? So in Canada, it's like, I don't know, like the idea, like Americans are all Clint Eastwood, you know?
Okay.
Get off my lawn, or whatever, I don't know.
Yeah.
And so it was like, oh, like we're trained. Watch out for those Americans because they all have guns.
Sure.
And they all voted for Trump or something, you know, you're like. And then it's like I've talked to so many different people from so many different states and everyone's just normal, man. It's like everyone's just, you know, have slightly different accent or slightly different whatever. But it's just like they're just people. Everyone's just a person.
Yeah. Yeah, I know that Trump is making us look real bad, and you know he's not the best. Actually, you know what? Maybe he is. Maybe he's the best face for us. It's like, this is about as hard as we're trying.
Right.
But I personally think he's just a catalyst for great change, and I think a lot of the pleasantness you may be encountering right now are people trying their best to enact that change. How can I not be a shitbag to everybody? How can I be nice? Because it seems like the world wants me to be angry, but no, I won't allow it.
It's interesting, right? It's like he's like a test of our collective morality.
Indeed. Indeed, like, so much. It's like, do you want to admit that this really is the proper representative for you? Do you want to admit it? Have you watched reality television at all?
Like, at what point does he go too far? At what point do we go, okay, he's finally crossed the line? So he's admitted to sexually assaulting women. That's okay. He's admitted to being like racist and homophobic, and that's okay. Okay, so he cheats on his wife. That's okay. He lies to the government. That's okay. He denounces the media. That's fine. I'm like, okay, okay. So he's in an illicit relationship with a porn star that contravenes federal law during an election. People are like, okay, closer. Closer. So what's going to be the final thing where it's like he's going to like kill a puppy one day and it's like, okay, you've done it.
No.
You finally crossed the line.
No, I don't think it's going to be him. I think he is the reality television that we want. And we're like, oh my God, look at it. It's like we can't stop staring at the car accident, you know? Like, we're just, you know, rubbernecking to see what's he going to do next, because it doesn't feel like it truly affects us, you know? So there's the level of what he does to how it trickles down. Nah, it doesn't affect anybody. And the people that are angry, thankfully, they will find a way to make change in whatever particular subset of problems they want to change. And that'll be great. They will be inspired to do great things, and I'm happy about it. But I don't think it's ever going to get to a point. I would put money on the fact that he is not impeached. I don't think he'll do more than 4 years, but I don't think he's going to be impeached. No.
I mean, I want to argue with you, but you look at all of the things he's done that are clearly being a bad person.
Oh my God, horrifying.
But clearly some of these 1,000 terrible things you've done are unpresidential. And yet, I don't know, it's like he doesn't seem even close to being removed. In a way, it's like, you know, and this is maybe a controversial thought, but I wonder if he's the best thing that ever happened to politics. He's like must-see television every night.
Yeah.
I loved Obama, but he was really boring. Okay,
yeah, right?
Obama looks cool again. I watch YouTube every day to watch all the different talk show hosts talk about Trump and the crazy things he did today.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, people are so obsessed with him. But it's almost like, if you ever, like even in a younger thing, if there's a person who's a jerk and everyone gives them attention, they're not going to stop being a jerk.
Well, and that's kind of what made him famous.
Yeah. He's been a jerk since the beginning. He's never stopped being a jerk. Like, I don't know. But that being said, like, there's a lot of people who are jerks. And, like, maybe 50% of America's jerks. I don't know.
And this I think reaffirms my theory in a slightly different way that I was talking about with me, right? It's like I've done all these things, but it's just my personality, right? It's just like I'm not doing anything. I'm literally just being like, you know, I think I had a moment on Facebook where I was in some sort of debate and then I got annoyed and then I just wrote, political correctness is intellectual cancer. And I got 350 comments in 24 hours.
Oh, yeah.
And things went crazy. And you know, I had like so many people freaking out and all these accusations and blah, 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 blah. And people were accusing me of being part of the alt-right. And I was like, I'm the first Chinese-Italian in the history of the alt-right. Like, give me a break, you know? But, you know, you see how crazy people get, right? And I was just like, and then I was talking to somebody. We had some sort of debate about something. And then they're like, this is who you are. This is your brand. I'm like, is it? You're the controversial guy. And it's like, I didn't even think about it. Like, I literally just wrote the 5 words. I just thought, you know, it's like, I guess I'm controversial. Like, there's a lot of people who sometimes I'll say things and they freak out and. I never tried to be controversial. And there have been times when I've, like, tried. Like, I'll be like, oh, you know what? I'm going to be controversial today. And then I don't know what I would say. I would say something about, like, oh, whatever. This ice cream is like Hitler or something. You know, I don't know. Something stupid, right? And then people would just be like, oh, stop trying to get attention. It's like you can't fake it. It's kind of like you are what you are. Yeah. And I feel like that – whatever it is that you are, like, it brings back certain energy into your life. and that becomes your life. And there's no curated strategy that can contravene that.
Yeah.
So
to bring it around with like the creativity, though, I really think that when you're a creative person, you kind of have to be controversial because you have to try to see things from everybody's point of view. Like, you're not just writing screenplays for liberals. You're writing it so that it will get purchased by a company that appeals to everybody. Even some of the ups and downs of Hollywood have a lot to do with how they are pandering to their markets. Who watches? Who are the people that watch it? What do those people want? Well, those are the kinds of movies that we're going to make then, because that's right. Who wants it, right? And to a certain extent, there's the controversy that is being creative and not part of that big machine. And then there's the controversy that's like, let's see what the zeitgeist is. And I kind of think that despite the fact that like for you being controversial, I think is totally natural because like your whole job is to be able to not only express the point of view of everybody in different perspectives, but also to understand it so that, you know, you can give them what they're looking for. And yet, at the same time, like, you know, yeah, people kind of jump down your throat and yell at you for saying something. And I think that's the trouble. I think the trouble right now is that we're in a bit of a how dare you vibe of society. Like, people get real mad. You know, we were given Facebook and, you know, Zuckerberg did not know what he was doing when he let us all say whatever we wanted to say. And then when we started saying what we actually thought, it was like, I disagree with you. And the only thing I stand for is what I've said online. So now we're enemies. And I, like you, I'm a devil's advocate. I want to, like, see where it goes. I will argue the opposite side of an argument all day if I think that there's a conversation we can have about it. And people will be like, do you really think that? I'm like, no, I don't really think that. They're like, well, why did you argue with me about it? And I go, I don't know. I just wanted to see if you could defend your argument. Pull it apart.
I'm the exact same. I mean, it's also like my dad's a lawyer, right? So I grew up with that, you know? I appreciate a good debate. I don't need people to agree with me.
Yeah.
I think my problem is that, and you're right, you hit upon these points. I think we're in the sort of like the culture of being offended.
Yeah.
And like being offended is like a form of currency now. And you're only valuable insofar as you're offended. And it's a real problem. And I think we've lost the art of a good, complex conversation. And so that's why I'd written that thing on Facebook about political correctness is intellectual cancer, because we need to be able to discuss complex issues in a complex way without just simply attacking people. And we can't just measure a debate by the number of likes that your friends give your shitty debate points.
Yeah.
You know, like we need to be able to talk about these things. And I think increasingly we are losing that art. So
I think it's coming around. I think
guess it depends on the forum. It's just not on Facebook. You just see so many people like,
oh, I don't think it's going to come around right now. No. I think that we need about 10 years before we are going to see the positive effect that what's happening right now will have on society. And I don't know how it'll affect Canada, to be honest with you. So maybe there'll be no effect. But like here, it is different. It feels different. And don't get me wrong, I'm in Texas. It's already pretty different. But like, the vibe of, you know, change and the, like, fervor with which I'm like, do it. You want to go out there and you want to get rights for women? Do it. Get out there. What do you want to do? Like, absolutely you should work on that. And I think that people are being empowered by having this negative force. This negative force is in the White House. We think, oh, no, it's not going to take away my country. And then the people who want to make the change have a fire lit under them to do it. So
right.
But that's not going to – so, like, the kids, for instance, like the high school kids stood up for themselves in Florida about the gun control stuff, they're going to be senators someday. Like, there is some kid in Houston who, like, got the highest marks of, like, anyone in the state on, like, his on his SATs to get into college and got, like, free ride scholarships to, like, every Ivy League school. And I was like, and my husband's reading me this article, and I was like, write his name down because he's going to be president. Like, right. That, it was like.
Well, that was Trump's strategy.
Yeah.
And that was
right? Those smart kids, get them in here. Oh man. So
no,
just...
but it's interesting. You're right. It's a state of flux, and you're and you know it's true. It's going to take a while to see the effects of the change.
Ooh. Also, I've just been slightly inspired by our conversation in so much as to say I was thinking about the plateau we've been discussing and how you and I are of the same age, right? And we're feeling the same thing. You could write a screenplay about people who feel like we do. They hit a rut. What are they going to do? I don't know.
Oh,
and maybe you
idea.
Can't write it. Maybe you can't write it for 10 years because you need to figure out what it's like to get out of the rut. And then you can write a screenplay that says, like, don't worry about it. You're going to be fine. You're going to get right
you know
through that
hate?
Rut.
I hate people who are constantly pretending that they fucking know everything. And it's like... Like, I'm pretty successful in many ways in my life, but, I mean, I can admit that I'm, like, in a funk, you know? I can admit that I'm, like, yeah. I don't know what to do right now. It doesn't mean I'm a loser. It means I just don't know what to do right now.
Well, yeah. I mean, every artist needs to spend time living their life so that they can be inspired. I mean, Disco Thursdays are going to help this, is all I'm saying.
Disco Thursdays. Wear the faux fur and the sequins... And the knee-high boots.
Your
that's
sunglasses better be huge.
Oh, yeah.
So just to wrap it up, I wanted to ask you, for people who are starting out in this industry, what advice do you have for them if they want to, you know, get the work done? What do they need to do to accomplish it?
Okay, so I will answer... with multiple points. Number one, do not enter this industry unless you love it. So if your ambitions are based on fame or attention or money or whatever you think this status is going to bring you in your life, if your intentions to be in the entertainment industry have anything beyond the love for making art, like acting, writing, directing, maybe you just love the industry, you want to be part of it. If you do not love it, get the fuck out. Don't even come in. You will be very unhappy. And I say this as a guy who's gotten lots and lots and lots of publicity. I've had more publicity than most of the world, probably. And like, it doesn't matter. Like, nobody cares. And I think the reason that I get so much is that I don't actually care. So then when actually people interview me, I'm actually myself because I'm not here trying to be like, man, I hope you like me. So then someone will take a picture of me and put it on a fucking billboard or something, you know. It's like, I'm just going to be myself because it's like, oh, okay, I can have a conversation. Let's do that. But so many people, I think that the reason that they're fake is that it's disingenuous. Like, they're going around crafting this strategy to try and like manipulate people into getting something. And I think that's a lot of people. So that's the first point. Point two, if you've decided you just love this field and you really want to make these kinds of things that we make in this industry, then do it your way. Every single person is a movie studio. Every single actor, every single writer, every director, every grip, everything you do in the industry, especially with today's technology and resources, social media platforms and distribution options, there's absolutely no excuse to not be curating content. And if you don't do it, it's a lost opportunity. Because what happens is that you're always going to have to beg other people for work. But when you make your own stuff, you lose that feeling of desperation. And then other people will start to hire you because they see you as a person who propels forward. And most people are standing on the sidelines begging. And it's a very, very unattractive quality. And the people who are more focused on pushing things forward and doing things are the people that everybody wants to work with. Mm. So that's what I would say.
That's great. Absolutely.
And come to Disco Thursdays.
Disco Thursdays and Bobby Del Rio's pad.
This has to happen now. I have to make this happen.
You better have a party. I want to see it. I'm following Thursday. Your Twitter at Bobman to see if I see some photos of Disco Thursdays.
If you ever see a naked photo of me, it'll be hashtag Disco Thursdays.
Well, I kind of hope I never do, but I do right. hope to okay. see that hashtag.
Okay. Okay. I understand. I understand your feeling of ambivalence. I get that.
There's just so many naked photos on the internet. You kind of avoid them.
It's true. It's true. You're one step ahead, as always.
Huzzah! Oh, Bobby, thank you so much for taking the time out of your evening to chat with me. You have been a delight. This has been a wonderful conversation. I wish you great success and passion and inspiration in the coming years. And I hope everybody watches your web series and your movies, and everything goes really well for you in the future.
Well, thank you. That was very nice. It was a lovely conversation. You know, you can tell when someone has passion for what they do. It really comes through, and it's clear you have a lot of passion. So.
Oh, thank you so much. Have a great evening.
You too.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why podcast.